RCE and 107.7 FM W299 CD Richland Center, and always on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Daria Albert. The LAPD says officers are removing some of the pro-Palestinian protesters from USC's Alumni Park as supporters chant, "Let them go." The protest reportedly did not have a permit. Rudy Giuliani, Mark Meadows, and former Trump attorney John Eastman appear to be among the 11 people who were indicted in Arizona for their alleged efforts to overturn the 2020 election. Secretary of State Antony Blinken in Shanghai to meet with Chinese business leaders is expected to warn them about the country's support for Russia.
The direction from President Biden and President Xi was to continue to build those lines of communication, to sustain them, and again, to deal directly with our differences as we also seek to build cooperation.
The Israel-Hamas war, trade, territorial disputes, fentanyl, and TikTok also loom large over these meetings. This is ABC News.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. The University of Wisconsin's flagship campus in Madison is slipping in the global and national rankings. The Wall Street Journal ranks it 79th. Internationally, UW-Madison has fallen to as low as 102nd in one ranking. Authors of the UW's internal studies say the UW-Madison gets fewer federal research grants. People who need a few hundred bucks in a hurry can take out loans on smartphone apps, but consumer advocates warn of steep hidden costs. Lucia Constantine is with the Center for Responsible Lending.
They are trapping consumers in a cycle of borrowing that is similar to that of a payday loan.
A bipartisan bill to curb predatory lending in Wisconsin stalled in the last session of the state legislature. And that's what you need to know. I'm Terry Bell, and this is Civic Media News.
Max Inc. on Civic Media, live in the lair with Kaylin Cole.
Have you ever walked away from a karaoke performance thinking, yeah, that was a lot better than the original person?
Oh my gosh, I don't know if I should admit that or not.
I think you should. Because now we know there's a song.
Jimmy's talking on it now.
I know. Oh, you're going to get me in trouble, Jimmy.
It's live in the lair. Grab the podcast now at maxincradio.com and listen live on Saturday night, 6 to midnight, across the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to News from the Center, WRCE.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to. Lots to talk about. My favorite tweet from yesterday was from President Joe Biden, where he said, "Don't inject bleach and don't vote for the guy who told you to inject bleach." Because yesterday was the day that Trump came out and said, "Hey, you know, if we could introduce some stuff, some light, you know, light bulb up the, you know, the backside, you know, maybe mainline, some Lysol, maybe you whip the virus." 4 years ago, that was the guy we had in the White House then. He is running again to bring that kind of sage advice back. And I found it interesting because I went and I looked back. Today, the owners of Lysol, Rickett Benckiser, a UK-based company, they own Lysol. They came out with a statement. They said, you know, as with all products, our disinfectant and hygiene products should only be used as intended and in line with usage guidelines. Please read the label and safety information. Their spokesperson said, as a global leader in health and hygiene products, we must be clear that under no circumstances should our disinfectant products be administered into the human body through injection, ingestion, or other route. The fact that they had to add the other route, that's frightening. Congratulations. I know it's hard to remember. 4 years seems like a long time ago. We did, you know, come out of a pandemic. And I get it. It's been a little rough. But it got me thinking that, you know, 4 years ago, things were not great. And when the Republicans, especially that woman from Alabama, the senator there, came out and said, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? Yeah, much, much, so much better off than I was 4 years ago, than the country was 4 years ago. And I got to tell you, I think we're in a good place. We're heading in the right direction. The economy is moving in the right direction because we're fundamentally changing things. That's important. I love the fact that, you know, Joe Biden is moving Bidenomics, which means we're going to build an economy from the bottom up. What good is having an economy if a good majority of the people aren't flourishing? If working people aren't able to get ahead? If you're not able to send your kids to college, you're not able to take a vacation, weather a storm. So what Biden has done, and good on him, it's about time we have an industrial policy, or reshore some manufacturing, invest in that, invest in infrastructure, some clean energy, expand opportunities for folks. This is what we should want from a president. What's Trump's ideas? Oh, we're just going to cut taxes for rich people. We're going to deregulate rich people even further. How does that trickle down to you or me? Oh, yeah. Doesn't. Doesn't at all. And again, it's about demonizing. It's about, you know, making the Democrats, especially on immigration. Immigration is a huge thing. I've been listening to people, especially my redhead friends, talking about immigration. And it's all this negative, ugly, horrible stuff. And you go, how did your family get here? We came the right way. And how was that? You got on a boat and you showed up. That's how you got here. I'm sure if there were a boat, if we were doing that again. Yeah. Now Biden has said, look, you know, we need to do something about the border. Send me a bill. You had one. Why didn't you pass it? Oh, that's right. Trump killed it. Because again, the issue is more important than the solution. They need immigration to make sure that, well, we keep people blinded by the anger and the hatred. Instead of, hey, how do we fix it? How do we get people here that we need to do the jobs that need to be done? Like, oh, I don't know, picking our fruit and our vegetables. I don't know about you, but I don't want to pay $12 for an apple. So if you can bring people in who want to do that work, hello. But there are so many differences. And then look, and that's just part of the economics. For me, it's all about the economics. It's all about the fact that what we've done is we've built an economy that makes rich people richer and poor people, well, expendable. And until we wake up to the reality that everything else is a sideshow, everything else is the cat chasing the laser, you know, the laser that Marjorie Taylor Greene wants to use on the border, until we figure that out, we're going to continue to get fleeced and angry. I've been saying for a long time, the reason that this country is so angry is the promise that we were told, again, work hard, play by the rules. You can finish the rest of it, get ahead. That's been broken. And until we figure out how to fix that, I don't think the anger goes away. People are they don't feel secure. They don't feel stable. At least most of the people I know don't. And look, we're being fed a constant stream of misinformation. The economy is doing fairly well. And yet you see report after report, Republicans say, it's in the tank. It's the worst economy ever. It's the worst economy ever. I literally had a red hat tell me, it is the worst economy ever. Ever? Did you forget about the Great Depression? Did you forget about the Great Recession just a couple of years ago? Have you forgotten, you know, about the booms and busts of the 1800s? You know, people were starving. Are you hungry today? No? Then I got to question that worst economy ever thing. But again, we're told this. We're fed a steady stream of dis and misinformation. So that we do what? We don't question why our wages haven't kept up with inflation for the last 40 years. And look, wages are rising faster than inflation right now. That's a reality. But you ask the average person, they don't know that. Ask them the last 40 years, has it kept up with inflation? And I think you would get a crazy answer. But I was just telling somebody the other day, you know, 30 years ago, I had a much better standard of living, a much higher income, you know, based on the wages that I earned, because earned higher wages for the day. When you do all that economic wizardry, add inflation into it. There's a beautiful calculator over at the Bureau of Labor Statistics that can help you go back. You know, what were you making in 1979? You can figure out what would it be in today's dollars. And how we can, I don't know, do it again. We've got a massive problem in this country. Inequality is a massive problem. But yet we're still focused on who's going to what bathroom. We're still focused on all of the things that the others, the things that are meant to keep us pitted against each other. You know, my gun friends are like, well, you know, Biden's going to take our guns. I'm going, did I miss that? Where's that going to happen? I haven't heard Biden talk about guns. So where is this? Oh, you've heard that on one of those. You know, okay. I got you now. How's the economy doing? It's terrible. Worst ever. So I'm telling you, we're in this place where we need facts. We need good reporting. We need accurate reporting, but we also need to talk to each other and question each other. So when I said, you know, worse than the Great Depression, the answer was like, well, maybe not that bad, but we're going to get there. And you go, no, we're never going back to that. But it's all about belief. It's not about fact anymore. And this is what the Trump era has brought us. Alternative facts. Alternative realities. I got to tell you, we need somebody in the White House who's going to move things in the right direction. I think Joe Biden's that guy. And I look at the fact that he's got really good people in good places. And when we come back, we're going to talk about one of those. Stick around. This is The Rick Smith Show.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So as I've said a number of times, I love a lot of Joe Biden's appointments. I love the folks at the Department of Labor, the people at the NLRB, Jennifer Abruzzo, one of my favorites, Lita Khan over at the Federal Trade Commission. Because on Tuesday, the Federal Trade Commission, they voted on a final rule that would ban this thing called non-competes, declaring them unfair methods of competition and doing away with a good many of them. And as we talked about, I don't know, about 12 years ago, there was that sandwich shop, Jimmy John's, who tried to make their workers sign non-compete agreements, basically making peanut butter and jelly proprietary. So if you make sandwiches for us, you sign this agreement, you can go nowhere else, which is crazy, which is why I think they should have been banned a long time ago, and good on this administration for moving forward, which is why I've asked Morgan Harper to come talk with us. She's the director of policy and advocacy at the American Economic Liberties Project, economicliberties.us, their website. We're going to find out what that vote was. Morgan, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me. Good to be back.
So, what happened?
Yeah, so yesterday was a huge day for anyone who cares about freedom, which I know is a really broad statement, but I mean it. It was a big deal that the Federal Trade Commission voted 3-2 to finalize this ban on non-competes. And, you know, I don't think it's that surprising that we had the three commissioners that have been in place for a while, based on, like you're saying, what we've seen from this administration. It's been pretty pro-worker, Lena Khan, Becca Slaughter, Alvaro Bedoya. But we have two new commissioners who have joined since last time we spoke. And unfortunately, they voted against the non-compete, which isn't good. But overall, this rule is huge. I mean, just like ticking through some of the impacts, this is probably going to impact like 30 million workers across the country who are dealing with these non-competes in positions from what you referenced, just sandwich shops, beauticians, sales positions, all the way up to folks like engineers and physicians who have been trapped and limited in their employment choices because of these non-compete clauses.
Now, you know, I had read something not too long ago that said, you know, the economic impact of this and what the Federal Trade Commission is saying is these are unfair methods of competition. It's stifling wages. It's holding wages down. And they said, you know, what I read was somewhere in the range of $300 billion each and every year that this thing that most people have never heard of is suppressing wages, and that by doing away with this, maybe working people get a fair shot.
Exactly. And actually, their estimate from the proposed rule. So, you know, there's this whole process whenever an agency does a rulemaking. We got the proposed rule and then the final rule. So yesterday was the final rule, which means in 120 days, this becomes law. And they increased their estimate of what the economic impact is going to be from $300 billion to over $400 billion. They're estimating will increase more money in workers' pockets, in addition to some other things like around innovation. So they think there'll be almost a 3% uptick in new business formation. Over 8,000 new businesses, they estimate, will be created because of this freedom that we'll all have as workers to leave a job, start our new business, apply the expertise that we have. And they also are estimating that the final rule is going to lower healthcare costs by quite a bit because of how much more money some healthcare institutions are able to charge because they're locking physicians into these contracts as well. So that's another big deal. They're estimating that maybe as much as $194 billion in savings for healthcare expenses because of this new mobility that physicians will be able to enjoy.
Are there, you know, because this seems to be a nonpartisan issue for me, you know, because when the Jimmy John's thing came up, you know, I would say, you know, is peanut butter and jelly proprietary? Can you only make it here? Now, I understand it's not enforceable at that level, but, you know, most employees don't know that. And most people don't want the hassle of fighting with a company over it. And most people just sign it because, hey, I need the job. You don't have any other choice. But is there any arena where these non-competes are something that should be around? Or is this something that should never happen?
Well, it's a great question. And, you know, the FTC had some choices here in how they were going to proceed. I mean, there's been, like, for example, in New York State, there was an effort to try to get this type of non-compete ban. And then people were arguing to get a carve out for certain professions and all of that. I think the FTC took a great approach here, in that they are banning them for all workers under their jurisdiction. So that doesn't mean, you know, 100% everybody, because there's some, you know, little market, like, for example, the FTC doesn't have full jurisdiction over all nonprofits, for example. There's some areas where maybe they didn't touch it. But for the most part, the vast majority of workers in the U.S. now, all across the socioeconomic spectrum, regardless of what kind of job you have, you will no longer be able, your employer will no longer be able to start a new non-compete contract with you or make you sign that. And you're absolutely right in terms of, you know, even if it's lower level, they're probably never going to go after you. There is a huge chilling effect to these agreements where you don't feel like you actually have the ability to change as quickly. You are worried that if a big, large corporation did decide to ever enforce it, you would never be able to have the legal resources to match that kind of challenge. And so they definitely were having an impact. So that's why it's so important that the FTC, you know, looking forward, no non-competes for any worker at any level.
No, to highlight what you said, Morgan, you know, the reality is I remember when I first started working, I was chasing nickels. You know, if the guy across the street was paying 5 cents more, that's where I was going. And if someone else down the road was paying a little bit more because I needed the money. And that's the reality. If you wanted to keep me, you were going to have to match that. And a lot of times employers did. So by having this non-compete, especially in the lower rung, as you pointed out, people don't have the resources. I didn't have $300 an hour to pay a lawyer when I only made $300 a week. I mean, and I think they know that. And this is another example of corporations knowing that they have outweighed power over their workers, and they have the ability to force things on them, like non-compete agreements, like forced arbitration clauses. We could go on and on. But this, again, for me, this administration taking this on is important.
It is. And, you know, I will say there was one clarification that the Federal Trade Commission made in the final rule in that. So if you have, you know, the existing non-compete agreement, so for people who are already in a job where one of these clauses was part of your employment contract, those are now going to be unenforceable. Right. And so you can now, if your employer does try to do that really messed up thing and intimidate you to think that this thing applies and you can't go to some employer across the street, you will now be able to say, hey, wait a second, the Federal Trade Commission just banned these things and you have no right over me in this way, right? But what they said was, if you're a senior, what they're calling a senior executive, if you're somebody that's making over $151,000 a year about, and if you have policy making or like decision making authority at the company you work at, then your non-compete agreement, if it's existing, holds in place. So again, anything moving forward, ban, regardless of what type of worker you are. But just for those that are already in place, they did carve out a little bit of the senior executives. And their reasoning there was, you know, these executives, they are able maybe to like seek legal counsel when these things are getting negotiated, if you're making big bucks and you have that available. But why they included them in the ban moving forward is, even the senior executive that gets counsel on one of these things, their inability to change jobs hurts innovation, like that new business formation thing that we're talking about. They also aren't able to, you know, be entrepreneurs, and that hurts the overall economy. That's not competitive, right? So just to clarify that point. But yeah, I mean, this is really huge in terms of being able to put power on the side of workers. I agree with you that this issue should be bipartisan, but unfortunately what we saw in this vote, those two votes that I said from the commissioners that voted against banning non-competes, did come from Republican appointees to the Federal Trade Commission. And that's a shame, because this should be uncontroversial. If you believe in workers having rights, if you believe in people being able to make money and have some control over their lives, then we should not have non-compete agreements.
Yeah, but that's if you believe that. I mean, you know, the reality is we live in an environment and have for a very long time where Republicans have been on the side of big business and the power of big business, and some corporate Democrats as well. I'm not letting them off the hook. There have been people who are like, I don't care. I don't care about that working person. It's all about the company, and anything that they get out of it will somehow maybe possibly trickle down. Never does, but that's the theory. So I get why the two Republicans would be against workers, because I say it all the time. Republicans hate working people. Look at what they do. And here, look at what they did.
Yeah. Yeah, it is really a shame. But you're right. I mean, we're in this era now. We're seeing it in lots of different facets, you know, within the administration, not just the Federal Trade Commission, the National Labor Relations Board. You said Abruzzo, General Counsel Abruzzo is your girl there, right? I mean, they're doing a lot of things that are moving power back on the side of workers. The other thing in this rule that's relevant, I would say, is they also are banning, for the most part, TRAPS, these training repayment programs, where I don't know if you've heard about these, but we actually had some of these in Ohio where I live, where you're working at like a massage therapist center, right? Or, you know, something like that. And that if you're working at one of those, they had non-competes on those, right? Or if you had gotten training to learn how to be a masseuse, that if you left, they were going to charge you for that training that they gave you to be able to perform your job. So these TRAPS are a whole nother area of, you know, kind of like non-compete like agreements that, yep, maybe they didn't have that exact terminology, but that through what the FTC has been doing here with this rule, through the work of some, you know, researchers that were making this connection, that these things are effectively non-competes and they should be banned too. And the Federal Trade Commission did include those in the rule.
I mean, look at my world in trucking. You saw that all the time. you know, we'll train you to get your CDL. But if you leave, you know, before 2 years, you got to pay us the $20,000 in training that we got you. So you're not going to go. And they know you're not going to go anywhere. And that's why they don't give you any decent wages. Right. You know, the same thing with lease agreements. They con these truck drivers into getting these lease agreements, pay them penny wages, and then say, hey, in, you know, 7 years, you can own this thing. It'll all be yours. And what you got is a pile of junk. And they know it. And these unfair things, it's not new. This stuff's been going on for decades. Just finally someone's doing something about it. And, you know, and it's, look, it's not just this. I mean, you know, I was talking to somebody the other day, and there's a lot of union organizing going on. And I go, I'm surprised that, you know, more workers aren't getting fired in these, because our labor laws are so pathetic. You know, wage theft is another thing. You'll get thrown in jail if you steal a peppermint patty. But if the boss steals your wages, slap on the wrist. Oh, don't do it again.
Yeah, I think it's such an important point, too, because, yeah, like you're saying, I mean, the reason why we're seeing more organizing is because workers' unions do know that they have an NLRB, DOJ that, you know, kind of from this administration that have their backs. So there's some room to be a little bit more aggressive. A lot of times, especially, you know, we're in an election year, I think people tend to focus just on the options for president. But we should spend as much time focused on who are these people that are populating the agencies that have all of this legal authority that can make decisions about, are we going to make the path easier for big business and the wealthy, or are we going to make it easier for the working people? And we've seen from this administration, it has consistently been the latter over the last 3 years. And I know, you know, in some ways, maybe a surprise to some, but it's happening, it's real. But we should also be aware of the counterattack is going to be just as strong. So with this non-compete rule, even, you know, a couple of weeks ago before the final rule dropped, we heard that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce at a big public event confirming they plan to challenge this thing right away and try to get it declared illegal for the FTC to ban non-compete. So we have to be vigilant and just like continuing to get the word out about how important it is to ban these things, and that this is what the American people want.
Now, this is another one of those issues, you know, the old labor frame of which side are you on? This is another one of those issues. Are you on the side of big money and corporate power? Or are you on the side of the person who has to clean up their mess, has to make them their profits? And look, I look at the two presidential candidates. It's simple for me. I know who Donald Trump appointed to these positions in the past. Eugene Scalia as the head of the Department of Labor. Are you freaking kidding me? A corporate lawyer who, you know, is a union buster. I'm sorry. I've seen this movie. It's bad.
Yeah.
I like what I see out of this administration.
Oh, sorry. Sorry. I didn't.
No, I said, I like what I see out of this administration.
Exactly. And I think increasingly what we're seeing too, and this holds true for the non-compete rule too, is it's not even like entirely bigger businesses versus smaller and worker. It's like, increasingly, it's just like the monopolists, the largest of the large, that are controlling such a huge swath of the economy, and everybody else. So there's actually businesses of pretty good size. And we saw even already, you know, yesterday after the rule dropped, some business groups that were coming out saying, this is great. This is going to help us innovate more. This is going to make it easier for people who want to be entrepreneurs. And so I think it's important for us to, you know, keep clear on whose side. It's not only, you know, just two sides. It's actually two sides that are like 50-50. It's like a 99% and then a 1%. And we need to stay clear on that. The other thing I would mention is a common argument, which I'm sure we're going to hear from the chamber and others, is, you know, we have to have these agreements to protect proprietary information, like the magic that is a peanut butter sandwich or whatever in your Jimmy John's example, or trade secrets that are involved in corporations that maybe, you know, work in tech or some other industries. And the thing is, they can still contract around that. If there's proprietary information you don't want workers talking about, then you need to make a contract that's about proprietary information. But that doesn't mean that you get to keep treating people like indentured servants who happen to be your employees at some point.
Yeah, no, and here's the thing. If they're that valuable, maybe you should pay to keep them.
Or that.
A final example. I mean, I look at, again, this administration, they've got someone in charge of the wage theft division of the Department of Labor who hasn't committed wage theft. I go back to the Trump administration.
Right.
It is.
The leadership has been great.
So last question I've got for you. You know, obviously, this is a step in the right direction. What's next?
So what's next is hopefully at an effective date. So like I said, 120 days before the rule becomes final. Right now, it's just been finalized with a vote, but it still has to get into the Federal Register. We anticipate there will be a lawsuit that'll try to block that implementation of the rule. And then it'll be up to a judge to decide whether or not to put the rule implementation on hold, like mean that it's not effective until the resolution of that lawsuit. Hopefully a judge would still allow the rule to continue, but that's a TBD. But what we know for sure here is that the FTC is on really strong legal ground. They lay out their legal reasoning for why they have the authority to do this deal. We know that this rule. We know that there's so many people across the country who would benefit from this rule. And so we just need to continue to get the word out about how impactful and positive a rule that's banning non-competes like the one the FTC just finalized is going to be for the American economy and workers.
No, it is good stuff. As opposed to, you know, the argument that they're making, as opposed to the other side, I don't want to. You know, it is what it
is. You got to play fair. You can still make some money, but you just can't treat people like sorry.
There you go. Morgan, I appreciate the time. Always great seeing you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Morgan Harper, Director of Policy and Advocacy there at the American Economic Liberties Project. Check out their website, economicliberties.us. We will get links out on social media. You can take a look at that. Going to take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. Stick around.
News from the Center, WRCE.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Mostly clear for tonight to a low around 30. For tomorrow, more sunshine with a few clouds in the afternoon and warmer, highs to the low 60s. Then rain rolls into the area tomorrow night and Friday, becoming breezy as well, highs upper 50s. And more showers and storms around for the weekend and cooler. Currently, it's 41 degrees.
Are you prepared for an emergency or disaster? Because it's not a matter of if, but when. Don't find yourself saying,
when the storm rolls in, my time to find a pet-friendly evacuation center will have run out.
The scorching heat wave will leave me powerless to cool my insulin.
I'll face a hurricane without meds. Now that's a tough pill to swallow.
Let's prepare so we all have a better story to tell. Get started at ready.gov/olderadults. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, I saw an interesting article written by our good friend Will Bunch, talking about the movie Civil War and pointing out the fact that it's really not about, you know, about the country, it's about journalism. And it piqued my interest, this idea that right now we're an alternative facts world. We're in a post-fact world, it seems to me, that we can't seem to agree on, well, anything anymore. Where in the old days, at least we agreed on something. Sky was blue, roads need to be paved, whatever. So here to share some thoughts on his most recent article titled Civil War is Terrifying, Not for What It Says About America, but About Journalism. That's why I've asked Will Bunch to come talk with us, national columnist at the Philadelphia Inquirer, also the author of After the Ivory Tower Falls, How College Broke the American Dream and Blew Up Our Politics and How to Fix It. Will, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, Rick, thanks for having me back. I really appreciate it.
So this movie, I haven't seen it yet. I've seen stories and clips and all that stuff. Yeah. Walk me through some of it.
Yeah, so obviously, you know, at a moment when everybody's focused on how divided the country is and the increase in political violence and, I've seen more people talking about the possibility of some kind of second civil war in this country more in the last few years than any time in my life.
And just talking about it, Will. I know people who want it. They're hoping for it, prepping for it. I know people have got guns and rice buried all over the place.
Yeah, and I think that's what inspired this Alex Garland, who's a British filmmaker. I think that's what inspired him to make the movie, right? It's like, well, if everybody's talking about this, well, what would it look like? And So the thing about Civil War is, I mean, it's a very visual movie. You know, it's an hour and 49 minutes, and almost every minute there are scenes that are supposed to shock you about what it would be like in America if we had, you know, years of civil war with armed militias and you know, and conflict between different factions. And, you know, he... You know, he comes up with some crazy geographic alliances. You know, there's been a lot of talk about how the main rebel army taking on the what's left of the U.S. government is the Western Alliance, which is this bizarre teaming up of Texas and California. So, and, you know, I think it was a device, you know, just like you said, you've read a lot about the movie, so you probably know that he really tried to avoid tough political questions. It's not a movie about conservatism or liberalism or socialism or, you know, none of that really factors into this movie at all.
Yeah, I mean, my sense is it's just violence porn.
Yeah. I was literally opening my mouth to utter those exact two words, because that is what it is. I mean, you know, in addition to show, you know, the shock of seeing bombed out strip malls and you know, JCPenney blown up, although most JCPenneys kind of look blown up these days anyway, but you know, and you know, McMansions and all these staples of modern American life, what they would look like if a Syria style, you know, civil war came to this country. And, you know, I mean, there's an element of, you know, are the chickens coming home to roost? You know, the main character played by Kirsten Dunst is this veteran heroic war photographer, who photojournalist who, you know, shot Haiti and Iraq. And there are a couple like split second flashbacks to the things she saw in other countries, and now they're happening here. And it's an interesting point that he doesn't really develop, but you know, like I said in my piece, the thing that holds together the movie's kind of thin narrative is the idea of journalism. You know, you have these four journalists on this circuitous road trip from New York to Washington, D.C., where the government's about to fall, or they believe the government's about to fall. And they're determined to, you know, it's like if the government's going to fall, they want to get the picture.
We need the clicks, man. We need the clicks.
Yeah. Well, it's weird, though. They never like post on Twitter or anything like that, which I thought was bizarre. There's definitely some weird logistical stuff going on in the movie, which I won't get off on that, but
I think the idea is from what I've read and the few things that I have seen is, you know, this idea that it actually can happen here, because, you know, yeah. If you would ask me, you know, 10 years ago, would we be in the position that we're in now, a president on trial, this tearing apart of us in ways where families are broken up, I would have said no, that can't happen here, but it
yeah.
is.
Yeah, you know, when I was a young adult in my 20s in the 80s when Reagan was president, if you remember, there were some movies, like there was the movie Red Dawn, right, where Russians invade the United States, or there was a kind of a now famous miniseries on ABC called America with a K, in which Russia, you know, takes over the United States. And obviously these fantasies were built not around civil war, but losing the Cold War. But the idea was, you know, war and tanks inside the United States and going past McDonald's. And isn't that crazy? I mean, could that even ever happen? And now it's like people go into the theater knowing, you know, hell yeah, this could happen. This could happen, you know, in a couple months, you know.
And some people want it. I mean, I remember those things like you do, like, and I remember them being not as a, hey, pick a side, but hey, we're all on our side. Let's move towards this not happening, as opposed to, hey, here's our blueprint.
Yeah. But also, you know, it was kind of like science fiction. It's like, wow, can you imagine this like crazy future where there's a war on U.S. soil, whereas it doesn't feel like science fiction anymore, right? So, I mean, the point I tried to make, and, you know, why, I mean, the movie clearly is about journalism, and there's a couple ways to look at it. On one hand, you know, the devotion of Kirsten Dunst and the other three journalists to get the story, to get the, you know, to chronicle in pictures, you know, what really happened to the government, to get a quote from the president of the United States. You know, I mean, clearly, you know, we live in an age where disinformation and misinformation, we're just drowning in it, right? So there's definitely a nobility to trying to get depict the actual truth of what is happening in this country, and certainly the characters in the movie try to do that, and they show how dangerous journalism could be in a situation like that, and you know, with a record number of journalists dying all over the world right now, that's a powerful message too. But what bothered me is, you know, there was no sense that maybe journalism could be a tool for somehow making America better, right? Or, you know, nobody's trying to save America at this point. And it's pretty clear from the movie that nobody's been trying to save America for a long time. You know, the kind of key quote in the movie about journalism and what their purpose is, you know, Kirsten Dunst tells her young protege that, you know, we record so that other people ask the questions, which, all right, well, who are these question askers? Because they should be out there asking, you know, why America became a fascist country. And I just thought it was so relevant to what's happening in our real nonfictional America right now. You know, we have too many people in the mainstream media are both sides in, for that, if that's the right term, you know, this presidential race between one party that has gone totally authoritarian or fascist or whatever you want to call it, and another party that in its own flawed way is trying to save democracy. And we just need an incredible sense of urgency right now about this situation. And
well, let me ask you this, though, because, you know, I just talked about this the other day. I don't think the vast majority of people, because I've heard this argument, you know, Biden's running on, we got to save democracy. And, you know, Trump's clearly with his Project 2025 and Schedule F and all of that stuff, clearly about bringing patronage back and authoritarian rule. And, you know, of course, all of his, you know, revenge and retribution and, you know, all of his petulance is coming back. But I argued that, you know, for a lot of people, democracy doesn't, I don't think it really matters. Because they're not free in their lives. They go to work. They're barely making it by. If you had an authoritarian leader who says, look, the trains are going to run. You're going to have food on your table, a roof over your head. I think a good portion of this country would be okay with it.
Sure. I mean, that's the message that Trump's been trying to run on really since 2016 when he said, I alone can fix it. I wrote last year about all the so-called intellectuals, quote unquote, on the right, you know, talking about how we need a red Caesar, which is their term for somebody who will just blow by the Constitution. And I mean, part of the problem is, I mean, you wouldn't even want that to get things. You wouldn't want that. You wouldn't want to make the trains run on time that way anyway. But what's even worse is, that's not even really what Trump wants to do. I mean, he wants retribution. I mean, that's what he says. He said at that rally in Waco, you know, I am your retribution. And, he's going to leave the specifics of authoritarianism to the Heritage Foundation people who are doing the project 2025 blueprint for him. And he's going to focus on, sending Democrats and journalists to jail, freeing the January 6th prisoners that he calls hostages, revenge. You know, that's going to be his priority, and it's going to be done in an authoritarian way. And
to this movie, I mean, you know, this is a cautionary tale of the hellscape that, you know, could potentially happen given the road that we're on. And that's frightening.
It is. But, you know, one thing about the movie is, you know, I mean, the journalists are the good guys, right? But in terms of people fighting for control of the country, there are no good guys and bad guys. I mean, you get the sense, I mean, you know, this Western Alliance, I mean, they, you know, they shoot people rather than take prisoners, you know, and without giving too much away, they're just as deadly and violent as the government is. So, you know, so who are the good guys? You know, I think you might be frightened and maybe a little bit demoralized by seeing this movie, but it's not going to give you any kind of sense of that was my take on it. This doesn't give you the feeling of how do you avoid fascism.
This is just, entertainment. It's violence porn, if that's your thing. But it's not going to move you in any direction that's going to be helpful. Because here's the thing, and this is, as a journalist, and you are a journalist, can you point to a time when, it was fair and balanced, where we all agreed on certain facts? Because I've had this argument before, and one of the arguments that keeps being thrown back at me is, yeah, we were divided. Yeah, we were partisan. Yeah, people had different directions they wanted to go, but they all wanted to do it for the benefit of the country. They were all working to make things better in their minds. Right now, I fear that the people who are pushing from the right are trying to tear this country down and tear it apart.
Yeah, well, I mean, look at public education, for example, right? It's a perfect example. Everything the Republican Party has been doing the last few years, none of it is about what parents want, which is making the schools better, making sure the schools have the financial support that their kids need to make sure that they have textbooks and that they can hire the best teachers. And,
it's about tearing things apart. No, just yesterday we talked about the lieutenant governor of Texas, calling for an end to property taxes, yes, in Texas, which would directly destroy public education, which is what they want. As you pointed out, it really is on their wet dream list.
Yeah. I mean, when you talk about how things have changed, I think back when, the fights that they had in Congress, which were not that difficult to resolve, would be, the government has to do certain things. It has to build roads. It has to, build dams. It has to fix bridges. And, the Democrats might come in as like, all right, we need $1 trillion. And the Republicans would come in and say, well, no, we should only spend $500 billion because we have to be responsible. And they'd argue and they'd make a deal to, to fund the government at $750 billion.
And then give the other money to corporations to put in their pockets. Let's not give them the high road of being fiscally responsible, because the majority of our debt is their fault. But go ahead.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, like you said, you're never going to have a perfect time. I mean, on one hand, you and I can have a long discussion of Reagan in the 80s and all the terrible things that the Reagan administration and the Republicans did at that time. But at the same time, Reagan did, when Social Security was in crisis, he came up with a plan. You might not like the way he did it with a payroll tax, but he did try and save Social Security. When people said your tax cuts have gone too far, there's a gigantic deficit, he's like, all right, well, we'll raise taxes back up a little bit. I mean, that wouldn't happen today. Republicans today wouldn't try and fix those problems. So I think that's the difference. I mean, you should never say, in the 50s or the 80s or go back to any fixed time and say things were perfect, because, any era in American history, I can tell you about some terrible things.
We've always had struggles. And, me, and this is where, and I'm rarely positive, this is where the positivity in me and loving this country, going, we've had rough times before. We literally had a civil war and we got through it. And this idea, this quest for a more perfect union, is something that, as a young kid, I learned about and I've internalized, and I believe we can get past this. I believe we can find a way at some point to reunite, even with the moneyed interests and all of the people pushing division.
Yeah, the bad news is, if you go through history, when a country gets really far off the rails, a lot of times something pretty bad has to happen, right, before people wake up and realize, and we don't want that, right? Yeah. We don't want a civil war. We don't want a war with other major war with other countries. I don't want any war with any other countries, but a revolution. I want to see some radical changes in this country myself, but I wouldn't want to see them through a revolution, because that would be undemocratic. I think most polls show a majority of Americans want a lot of the same things that I want, a higher minimum wage and other type reforms that would make this country better. It's just the disconnect, which you know well about you know, moneyed interests and other things that that block the you know, the popular will of the people from happening in this country. So if we can somehow break that logjam, yeah, there's definitely reason to be optimistic. It's because I think, you know, I think we know, I think you and I both know that most people want things that would make America better. It's just the system has malfunctioned to a point that we can't have those things.
Yeah, right, we do want to make America great, just not through the Trump the Trump vision, which you attended one of the rallies recently. What was that like?
Yeah, well, that, I mean, it's funny because that plays in exactly to what you and I have just been talking about, which is, to me, the theme was just disinformation, you know, that, you know, I talked to maybe 20, 25 people, 30 people, I don't know. I talked to a lot of people on the line waiting to get into the rally, just because that's the reason I went there, was I didn't care about the rally itself. I wanted to take the pulse of who, you know, who's still out there enthusiastic about Trump after all the last crazy 8 years, and what's motivating them. And, you know, people talked to me, not everybody wanted to give their name, but people, you know, were happy to tell me what they think of the current political situation in this country. And what they think is, you know, it's just a giant cloud of disinformation has settled over these people. You know, it's like, you can't convince them that this isn't the worst economy in American history. You know, you can't convince them that,
but they're fed, they're clothed. They've got a roof over their head. They drove there.
I mean, that's the other thing, you know,
they're buying $40 hats made in China. They're completely dressed up in $400 Trump shoes. But it's the worst economy ever.
Yeah, I know. I mean, they want the. Yeah, it's exactly right. They want you to know how well they're doing personally. You know, it's that, you know, it's more. You know, the mentality behind the Trump voter has always been more, hey, you know, I'm doing well, but I didn't go to that fancy elite college that you went to, but yet I'm still making enough money to buy a powerboat or something like that. And, you know, why do you look down on me? Why don't you give me credit? Why does society look down on me for not having a fancy college degree or for something else? And so, you know, so they resent the people they think are looking down on them, yeah. Which are Democrats, liberals, college professors, journalists, movie stars,
the next door neighbors.
They don't resent CEOs who, you know, outsource jobs or that sort of thing. Those people are fine, but college professors are, you know, threatening their way of life. So
very twisted, very twisted. But Will, I appreciate the time. I appreciate the work you do over there at the Inquirer. Always great time talking with you. I appreciate it.
Yeah, Rick, it's always fantastic. Thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Our good friend Will Bunch. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Are we on the brink? Is it possible that we could end up in a civil war? Sure hope not. But I do know a lot of people who are hoping and praying, literally praying for a civil war. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1999. A headline from the Los Angeles Times declared dock crews to halt work in support of death row inmates. Up and down the West Coast, the ports stood silent. The International Longshoremen and Warehousemen's Union had called their members off the job for a one-day strike. They did this to protest the death sentence for Mumia Abdul-Jamal. Mumia was a black activist and journalist who was on death row accused of killing a police officer in Philadelphia. Yet many peace and justice activists in the United States and beyond have questioned the evidence leading to his conviction. In October of 1998, the Pennsylvania State Supreme Court rejected an appeal from Mumia. Jack Heyman, a member of the executive board of the Longshoremen's Union in San Francisco, explained the context of his union's protest in a piece he wrote for the San Francisco Chronicle. He wrote, quote, "Labor and minorities share a common history of being victimized by the criminal justice system in this country. Both have long been aware of police repression and the unequal use of the death penalty against minorities and the poor. From the Haymarket Martyrs, who rallied workers for the eight-hour day, to Harry Bridges, the Longshore Union leader targeted for deportation for being a Red, to the Black Panther Party, whose program of self-defense put it on the FBI's list. In San Francisco, longshoremen chanted, "An injury to one is an injury to all. Free Mumia Abu-Jamal." Protests against Mumia's execution took place across Europe in cities like London, Madrid, Dublin, and Amsterdam, and by unions in France, Brazil, and South Africa. After 30 years on death row, Mumia's sentence was commuted to life without parole. He is still in prison.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I want to pick up on something that Will Budge said a minute ago, because I think it's important. I think it's important to understand. I think all Americans want the same things. I've said this before. I think all Americans, regardless of their political affiliation, deep down, when you talk to them individually, get them in groups like at a Trump rally, forget it, all bets are off. But individually, when you talk to people, they want basically the same stuff, especially when you're talking about working people. You know, we want good jobs. We want fair wages. We want opportunities. We want economic stability. To me, that just makes sense. You want work hard, play by the rules, get ahead. That get ahead part should be there without question. You want safety and security. You want to make sure your neighborhoods are safe, your communities are safe. You want to make sure that when your kids are walking home from school, they're going to be okay. I don't know that this is all that hard. They want high-quality public education, affordable college, options for kids who don't want to go to college, vo-tech stuff. They want opportunities. And yet all we keep hearing from, especially from the Republicans, more tax cuts for rich people, privatization. You know, you ask the average American what's important to them, affordable quality, high-quality health care. When they get sick, they don't want to go broke. When little Susie falls and breaks her arm, do you want to take her to the hospital and not be, hey, is this going to bankrupt us? You know, we want a safe environment. We want clean air, clean water, clean natural surroundings. We want to leave something worth inheriting to those children that we care about. We want good infrastructure. We want good roads. We want good bridges. We want public transit. We want utilities that work and aren't going to go out and, well, not gouge us. You know, there are a lot of things that could bring us together. We want strong communities. We want vibrant communities. We want opportunities to connect socially and culturally and have civic engagement. We want to have all those things. But it seems that what they've figured out how to do is slice, dice, divide, and pit us against each other. And again, you come back to, you know, individually, every one of those Trump people at the rally, they want the same thing that I want, that you want. Deep down, they want to be treated fairly. They've been told that they're the victims. They want to be treated justly. They've been told that they're not, repeatedly. And who is it? Well, it's those people. And, you know, fill in the blank of who those people are. Those people du jour, based on race, gender, orientation, religion, whatever, color of your hair. We want the same stuff. We believe, for the most part, and I've had these conversations with red hats for a couple of years now, where once you strip down the groupthink, what is it that you individually want? They want economic stability. They want personal freedom. They want the things that everyone values, because they're American values. And the sad reality is, and I actually don't know where all this is coming from, but there's a lot of organized money. A lot of organized money going into tearing us apart in this country. And as I said a minute ago, you know, we had our divisions in the past, but I believed back then everyone was trying to make this country the best it could be. They had different views, different values, different visions, but it was still about making this country the best it can be. I look at the Make America Great crowd, and it's not about that. It's about exacting revenge and retribution. It's about enriching the handful over everyone else. It's about hooray for me and the heck with everyone else. And that is a problem. That's not the America that I grew up in. It's not the America I grew up believing. And for me, we are in this really interesting moment. And I think Will, you know, hit on it, where our media, I don't half the time know who to believe, because there's so much disinformation out there. There's so much, well,
BS to have to wade through. But I still have faith in us. I still have faith at the end of the day, we are going to come back together. We are going to reunite. And we are going to make it better for our kids. I want to hear your thoughts. If you missed any portion of the program, podcast, TheRickSmithShow.com. I want to hear from your email, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. I do answer all emails personally. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com.
This is News from the Center, 1450 AM WRCE and 107.7 FM W299 CD Richland Center. And always on the Civic Media app.